Here I am in Bisbee with Bill Carter. I'm Dr. Dan Twelker, working for KXCI, 91.3 FM KXCI. And we're just chatting. We're talking about the books you've written, Fools Rush In, Red Summer. We're talking about Tucson and Southern Arizona music and about the world, too.
Yeah.
Some similarities between what happened in the siege, Yevo, years ago now.
Right.
And also what's happening currently in Gaza.
Right.
Yeah, some similarities. Big differences, too. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. There's big differences.
War in an urban environment.
Right.
Where
that's
people
right.
are cut off, in many respects, cut off from food, water, medical aid, things
right.
like that.
Correct.
That's what was happening in Sarajevo.
Because most of the time, people think of... like, one of the reasons that Africa is a difficult thing for people to wrap their head around is that, like if you read the paper, I'm sure if you read it today, it'll say there's some sort of a scale massacre in Eastern Congo. But Eastern Congo doesn't, when I say Eastern Congo, nobody has a clue of what Eastern Congo is, visually. Like, they don't know what it looks like. They can't name one town there. And that's not really anybody's fault. What I'm saying is there's no urban gathering, which changes how we think about things. Oh, that's a house, it's apartment buildings, they got cars, they got buses, you know, it's, I've been there, whatever it is. Eastern Congo or Sudan, Darfur, people don't know where it is in their minds, like geographically, they can't put their heads around it. It doesn't excuse it. I'm just saying that it's the initial reaction of how people react, you know. And, it kind of leaves Africa in the lurch, because you know if there was a war like in you know Cairo, it'd be different. People go, oh, I know Cairo, but they don't know some of these other places because there's no identifiable spot, and so it kind of lets the massacres continue without much interference. You know, it's one of those problems.
Sure.
You know. I'm hoping to go to the Congo this year, so that'd be interesting.
Do you want to say what your next book is about?
Oh, no.
No?
No, no.
No, you're not going to mention it. You're going to talk about that.
I'll ruin it if I do that.
Yeah.
The books are weird. You know, they take years, so you have to really protect them.
Yes.
It isn't really like a... It's not like you're trying to be difficult. It's more like you yourself are growing inside of them, and you just have to let them just kind of be quiet in you for a long time. That's the way I see it. You know, I'm involved in right now with, you know, in a Hollywood kind of way with my Fools Rush In with the screenplay and trying to make the movie. And there's a great lessons in dealing with Hollywood. And one of them is it's all nonsense until it's real, you know what I mean? So I'm in the middle of like nonsense right now, and it kind of translates to everything else I do, which is, it's nonsense until it's real, you know?
Sure.
Or if it's not, it doesn't have to be nonsense, it just means that it's still developing. How's that?
You know? Absolutely. Let's talk about, I believe it's your most recent book, because it's the one I've read most recently, which is Red Summer.
Yeah, it came out about 6 months ago.
Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, you lived in Alaska for a while.
Yeah.
Way back when.
Yes.
Way back in the day. And then you then went back, within the last 5 or 6 years, you were working in the summers.
Right.
Commercial salmon fishing.
Right.
Tell me more.
Yeah, originally I was there. That's where I met the fiance, who then died in Fools Rush In. And when that, I remember telling myself, I'll never go back to this. It was called, the place I met her was in a place called Knack Knack. And I said, I'm never gonna go back to that place ever again in my life. I'll never go there, ever. And in 2002, I was picking tomatoes on the Sacramento River outside Chico, just trying to earn $6 an hour and wait for my manuscript to get accepted for Fools Rush In. And the phone rang and someone said, do you want to work on a crew in Alaska fishing? And it came out of nowhere. I mean, it came out of, it was a friend of a friend that told, you know, said that he, I could do it. And, you know, she gave me about 2 minutes or so to decide. It was a woman, which is very unusual for a captain in Alaska. And she basically gave me 2 minutes or less to decide. And I said, okay, I'll go there. And she said, well, you have to be on a plane tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. and be fishing by the next day. I knew what fishing was, but I also knew it was hard and dangerous. And then I kind of arrived and started fishing immediately, you know. And it was radical.
Sharon called you. She said, be on a plane at 6 a.m. the next day.
Right.
How do you know what to pack?
She told me. She's very specific. Because I didn't know. Good question. I didn't know either. I'm like, what do you take fishing and not take too much and, you know, all that? And she said, go to your thrift store and buy four or five pair of sweatpants, hooded sweatshirts, socks, and a pair of tennis shoes that's one size too big, and gloves, and a beanie, you know, and make it all crap clothes, like nothing new, because it's all going to be destroyed. So I did that. I just went down and bought all this stuff and, you know, spent, what, $80 on used clothes and put it in a big duffel bag, and I was on a plane. And when I arrived, she was fishing, so I had to wait actually till like midnight for her to finish fishing, to meet her. Because, you know, the sun never sets, and the fishing is not really based on the clocks of a business in America. It's based on the tides and rivers. So you can be fishing at 3 in the morning or 3 in the afternoon. You don't know. So, yeah, I was fishing pretty much right away the next day. And she, you know, Sharon's an extraordinary woman. She's also quite, she's been fishing for 26 years. You don't fish as a woman in Bristol Bay, Alaska, without having a pretty rough edge. You don't survive. So her rough edges are to be expected. But that doesn't make it easy for your very first days with her, because she's not going to baby you. Do you know what I mean? Like, and you have to learn that about her and accept that and just do it or get off the boat and go home, you know. And she's gone through lots of crew, like every captain. It's not because she's tough. No, she's no tougher than anybody else, but I think that she maybe a little bit has more of an edge, because to be a woman in that business, she had to be. So anyways, but the thing is, it's a little bit like the other book in a sense that I went to a place that's extreme, but then I met these amazing characters. I met these amazing people. And both times, I didn't go to write a book. I went to Sarajevo to who knows what. I mean, to the extreme, I went there to disappear. And I didn't. And I found myself redemption, if you want to. I mean, I found myself living again at in a really extreme level. And in Alaska, on the very most basic level, I went to make money. Like, you know, 5 weeks, let's make some money because I'm broke. And at the second level, which is always in me, which is someone offered me an adventure, I'm going to go. So those two things together. I didn't start thinking about the book until maybe my third year. I went back the second year just to, because I fell kind of in love with Sharon and Carl, her fishing partner, and people I met. I just loved the vibe and the camaraderie. But it's a very extreme place. It's not, I mean, the weather's extreme, nature's extreme. The people are very extreme. The work is extreme. And inside that, it's a little bit like Sarajevo. The reason I found Sarajevo very comfortable is because if I'm sitting in a room with Bosnians in that war, and they're playing music and they're smoking hash and they're laughing, if you take that scene out of context, people would look at it and say, oh, they're okay, they're having fun. No, that's not what's happening. What's happening is that they're surviving, and this is the way they're surviving. They're letting loose because they trust everybody else in this room has the same shared experience, so they can be themselves. Grief's like that. Grief's like that, because if someone dies and you have a tough month, and then someone sees you laughing, they assume you're okay. Or they want you to be okay. They're like, oh, you're okay now. No, I'm not okay. I'm on the roller coaster of hell. And right now, I'm laughing. It's so in Sarajevo, you were safe. And so it allowed people to be very free and very funny. And in Alaska, everything's so extreme, and no one understands what it takes unless you're doing it. Then inside that bubble, people are very free. You know, because they know that you know, and he knows exactly what we all do. So it's inside these things, you find a very freeing experience, you know, which I tend to really be attracted to. So.
Yeah, the common theme I've seen, not only in the two books, Fools yeah. Rush In, Red Summer, and you also did a trek across Utah.
Yeah.
With very little supplies.
Right.
So, but all of these things, extreme situations.
Yeah, that was 300 miles, 30 days, and a knife and a cup, and, you know, extreme situations. Not looking for death. I'm not a death seeker. I'm not even a thrill seeker. Like, meaning, I'm not an adrenaline junkie. I'm more of a, I find life rich in these moments. And it doesn't have to be death, life-threatening. Sometimes it is, but it's not my point. You know what I mean? Like, I could, and also I like working. I'm a worker. I like to work. If it's fishing, I like to work. If it's whatever it is, bartending, I love to bartend. You know, whatever it is, I like to do it because I meet people there being themselves. And it isn't like an angle into a book, usually. It's just kind of where I'm heading in life. Then I'm like, oh gosh, that's a pretty interesting place. I should write a book about it. I need to change that because, you know, eventually it takes too long to write a book. You know, it takes years to live these things. So I'm trying to change that right now and just write a book a little bit different now. I mean, I'm writing a book right now and I'm trying to do it reversed. Like, pick a topic, be interested in it, and go find out, and then write the book. But not be even that involved in it, like physically, you know.
So you have Red Summer, mm-hmm. which came out fairly recently, Fools Rush In.
Right.
What other books have you written?
Well, that's the only two books I've written. And then I have a third book I'm working on for Simon Schuster, like Red Summer. And then we're making Red Summer, actually, into a documentary. And that's going to be quite a big production that, as far as I know, will happen this summer. So that's going to take several months of this year to do.
How can people get a hold of your books?
Well, you know, like, you know, these days, book buying's a weird thing. I mean, you know, heck, I don't even know how to get a hold of my books if I walk in a bookstore because it's too confusing.
I went to Antigone Books on 4th Avenue,
okay.
and I asked if they had it, and they said, no, this is Red Summer. But they said they could order it, and within 2 days, they
right,
had it.
Right, right. I think that's the best way. You go to your local bookstore, and ask them, and they order. They can order anything, you know what I mean? I mean, some people like to use Amazon. That's always an option.
Barnes & Noble. You have a website, too.
I do have a website.
Can you order from that?
It allows you. You can order from my website. Not from me, but it kind of links you to the world of ordering.
What was the name? It was www.
My website is www.billcarter.cc. It's not .com. That's a real term, Los Angeles. So I had to pick a different domain. So it's BillCarter.cc. And then, you know, both books. I do a lot of photography on there. Articles from magazines. So there's a lot of stuff on there, you know. And you can find out how to get books. I mean, I wish I could walk into more bookstores and, not my books, buy any book, but quite often they don't have the book you want. So it's always a matter of ordering. The big battles that's brewing in Alaska is a mine that might open, Pebble Mine. And it kind of came on the radar during the Sarah Palin campaign because she backs it. And of course, it's a mine. This is nothing against mine because it's a controversial topic, but people, you have to mine something or else you don't have what it takes to run this equipment right now. But many times it's where you mine. And this mine will be on the headwaters of the largest wild salmon run on the planet. And no matter who builds a mine, it's going to leak. It just does. It's just groundwater, you know what I mean? It's one of those inevitable things. So you have to really think, do you want arsenic going into a wild salmon run? Probably not. Because you'll lose one of the biggest resources left on the planet that's wild. So there's a big battle there. So just, you can go find ways to fight that, which I'm involved with people on that. You know, stuff like that. Or if you want to fish in Alaska, I have all kinds of resources. If you want to go try, your hand at fishing, here's how. Mm-hmm. No guarantees you can get on a boat, but there's resources to find out. You know, it's an amazing adventure. Changes your life, you know.
How are you physically now? You mentioned some repetitive stress injuries that you sustained.
I'm okay now. I mean, I have kind of a permanent problem in my left arm, but it's nothing that's going to ruin my life. But there's now a bar that I never had in my life where if I put X amount of stress on that arm, I know where the pain is coming from, what I did fishing. You know, nobody comes out of fishing, unless you're 18. You know what I mean? I'm not. If you're 18, you can probably do it for a couple of years and never even think about it. But if you do it for several years in a row and you're 30 and higher, something's going to be permanent on you. Whether it's chop your finger off or broken bone or tendons or, you know, something. And something's going to happen.
People die.
Every year people die. Without a doubt. I mean, you know, it is technically, without sounding like a freaking cliche, it's the most dangerous job. That not a soldier. I mean, a civilian job is the most dangerous job there is. But by far, like two times as much. And every year I fish, people will die near us or something. And usually it's not what you think. It's not like maybe the end result is they drowned. But it isn't like they just fell over because they're stupid. Something happened where the reaction wasn't as fast as it should have been. A rope hit them, an anchor hit them, a net hit them. You know, there's so many moving parts when we're fishing that's happening so fast that you just got to pay attention constantly. You know, really, there's no downtime. You know?
Well, you described skiffs or boats full of fish.
Right.
Where you're trying to get from the middle of the river to the shore,
right?
But then the boat's so low that you have wind and waves coming over the over the bow or over the side,
right? And you're loaded with fish because that's why your boat's low,
and so boats go down. And
they swamp, right? Yeah. And there's a lot of one of the biggest problems is that when you're loaded like that, that means that it's a big day, and that means it's a big day for everybody. So there's lots of nets in the water, lots of lead lines, like very taut lines that are like, you know, bouncing because of the tension of the water. And they're all over the river holding anchors, holding buoys, holding stakes. You know, they're just everywhere and you can't see them. And those are what happens is, and if you're fishing at night in fog, you don't see them. And those things can catch your prop, catch something on, and then all of a sudden your boat is sideways in a river that's going 5 knots. And you're loaded, you have like under 30 seconds to get that unsideways, or else it's just gonna, you know what I mean by sideways? The water is hitting on it.
Yeah.
It's gonna push it, it's gonna tip it under. So there's lots of things happening. And Sharon was an amazing captain, and Carl, both of them are great fishermen. So I always felt safe, but, you know, and I could really tell where we were at by them. Not physically, but like, they were very rarely worried. If they were worried, they never said it. But I could tell by how sharp they got or how attentive they got to like, okay, now I need to pay really serious attention, because there's a real casualness about them, even in the middle of hard times. So when they were quiet and kind of paying attention, then I knew that we were like really in deep water or deep situation. And we got into them every year, can't help it. There's too many factors to stay away, to keep it totally safe. But fascinating, totally. And you know, the bears and the fish. You know, one of the things I tried to stress in the book, and I think the book in my mind, I wanted to make it a lot about nature and environment, not like in a preachy way, but in a kind of a wonder way. Like, one of the things about the place I spent a lot of time in Alaska, Ikigik, is that, and really the thing that kept drawing me back, maybe even more than the people I met, was that you go to this place, you get off this, you know, you land in a little tiny plane, four-seater, in a little tiny dirt strip. It's a little village of 80 people. Yupik Eskimo village. And there are grizzlies, there are wolves, there are foxes, there are beluga whales in the river, there are walruses, seals, and there are 30 million sockeye salmon. And, you know, I've been all over the world. I've been everywhere. I mean, I've been to all continents. I've been to many countries. And I've never been to a place like that. I've never been to a place where the abundance still exists. You know, right now, if you want to get a fish in Tucson, you're probably buying it from a farm. If you want to get a piece of meat, you're probably buying it from a corporate farm. If you go to Ikigik, you're eating caribou from someone's freezer or moose from their freezer, and your fish, I can go out there and put a net out for 5 minutes and get enough fish for this whole restaurant for 2 days in 5 minutes. And that doesn't exist anymore in the world. It's very hard to find that, and that to me was thrilling. Also, it makes it very aware that you have to protect it. I think it's okay to manage it, and I think they manage it very, very well up there. You have to give them credit for that. Very, very well managed, but it's there, and it still exists, and that makes it kind of magical for me, you know. And I think that's a big part of why I kept going back, and still will, you know. So
I'm Dr. Dan Twelker, and I'm here in Bisbee with the Savory Spot.
That's right. Yeah.
Cafe. And I'm talking with Bill Carter about his book, Red Summer. And previously we were talking about Fools Rush In, another book that was published, 4 or 5 years ago?
2005 in America.
2005.
Yeah.
4 years ago. And I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about this.
Sure. Oh, thanks for coming down.